pleasure this evening to have Dr. Gary Shogren, Associate Professor of New Testament here at Biblical, to speak to us on the paths of justice, divine standards for human social righteousness. Dr. Shogren did his undergraduate work at Philadelphia College of the Bible and seminary work here at Biblical, then went off to Scotland, where he earned his doctorate in New Testament at the University of Aberdeen under I. Howard Marshall. Gary has been pastoring for several years and has started a family, so he's learning a little bit about social righteousness here, practical ways. So we're glad to have him to come and speak to us on that subject.
I picked this topic out months and months and months ago, long before I wrote this paper. And I think if one of my students turned this in as a topic today, I would write back in red ink, "Too ambitious, try again." But now I'm stuck with it, so here it goes. What is the path of justice? As an American, I have certain assumptions. I know, for example, that I've been treated unjustly according to the Constitution if my home were searched without a warrant, violating the Fourth Amendment, or if I've been forced to testify against myself, violating the Fifth Amendment. But injustice is hard to define abstractly and precisely, justice even more so. But like so many other things in life, we just claim to know it when we see it. I think the news last week gave us some excellent examples, some good sermon illustrations for the night. I think the great majority of Americans could not tell you why in philosophical terms, but they do feel deeply based on what they saw on a videotape that Rodney King was not dealt justice. And later on, when rioting and looting followed the verdict, King himself went on television to condemn the beating of a truck driver with the words, "It's just wrong, it's just wrong." I had a chance to delve into this topic a little bit this year, something I wasn't very familiar with to begin with. I had to kind of start from scratch. I was invited last year to take part in writing some short articles for a new book by Baker Bookhouse called The Dictionary of Biblical Theology. And their instructions were clear. What they wanted was for their writers to encapsulate biblical teaching on selected topics. Nothing new, please, no original thinking, no modern theology. They just wanted, what does the Bible say about this topic? Out of my four assignments, I had a 500-word article on justice. And with a lot of squeezing and cutting and chopping out, I managed to get it down to 750 words. And it slid through the editor last month. And that's a copy of my article, which I gave as a handout, which I'm not going to be referring to directly tonight. The Bible isn't written in dictionary genre and does not give us a definition of justice. So what we do is we need to bring together and analyze mounds of data in an inductive study to try to determine how we may walk in the path of justice. And I could say with this article, I had to look at hundreds and hundreds of verses in their context, and I was just amazed at how many biblical verses dealt with this theme. What I'd like to focus on today is one part of my analysis, and that is what constitutes justice in the human realm, and to describe some of the biblical accounts of justice, primarily from the Old Testament. Solomon said that it is not good to be partial to the wicked or to deprive the innocent of justice, Proverbs 18 from the NIV. That sounds reasonable, but we have to take into account that Solomon is assuming a great deal of the reader. He does not define wicked or innocent, nor does he define justice. He's assuming that wickedness is what God says it is, and as a good Israelite king, he believes that God has told him what is good and evil in the law. A breach of justice consists of a verdict that ignores or runs contrary to both the letter and spirit of the law, or of God's revealed will, or that does not accord with the known facts of the case. That information is useful for us today, but rarely applied. Even if we take into account that we are not bound to the Mosaic system of justice in the same way that the theocratic nation of Israel was. But in societies that are influenced by the gospel, the final arbiter of right and wrong may well be some moral standard as found in the Bible. But what about those nations, including those of the West today, that officially reject that standard? Some may exist or accept the existence of some kind of natural law, an inherent knowledge of right and wrong, that might possibly be standardized into a code. This view is affirmed by many Christians and non-Christians, and it's a skeleton on which America's independence took shape. It is self-evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. The weakness of natural law theory is that there is no firm consensus in any society over what constitutes such self-evident law. For example, today in the battle over abortion, some Americans accept it as a given that the unborn have a right to live, while others find it equally obvious that a woman has an inherent right to privacy. Still others will reject both biblical revelation and natural law. Thus, when Clarence Thomas was nominated to the Supreme Court in 1991, some began to question his suitability, even before the Anita Hill problems, because of rumored suspicions that he believed in some kind of higher law. When things go this far within a society, the authority for law must then come from consensus or expediency. Justice becomes truly arbitrary because it has no guiding star. And if truth cannot arise from some consensus, it will probably come from those who shout the loudest. The Bible will reject justice by consensus, but it will also reject natural law theory if it stands alone. While the Bible affirms that even fallen human beings are made in God's image and that societies may inherently know something about right and wrong, it proclaims that true human justice must be based on the supernatural revelation of God's will. The whole Bible is clear. Justice is that which God says it is. Let's examine how that worked in the case of the Israelite nation with their judicial system. Imagine, if you will, a world without lawyers. Such was the judicial system of the Old Covenant. Indeed, there was no public prosecutor either. People simply brought their own complaints to court. A court might consist of a judge or several judges who would listen to both sides of the case and carefully interview the witnesses. He would then give a verdict and see that the judgment was carried out. Courts might convene only when a case arose, and they were commonly held in a public place such as the city gate. When men have a dispute, they are to take it to court, and the judges will decide the case, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty, Deuteronomy. The Israelite judicial system, and I don't mean by that the Mosaic law, but the system seems to have developed over the centuries. Before Moses, it seems to have been administered by family heads. Moses himself judged every case that was brought before him until this was deemed impracticable. After this, he handled cases that could not be solved by lower courts. Under the monarchy, the king was the ultimate arbiter of justice. A system of lesser district judges was organized during the United Monarchy, and it was later thoroughly reformed by Jehoshaphat, 2 Chronicles. His name, ironically, perhaps means Yahweh has judged. But it is Solomon that's held up as the ideal just king. When he prays for wisdom at the beginning of his career, he's not just asking to be made smarter, but for the ability to judge his people rightly. Give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong, 1 Kings. After God grants him his request, Solomon has a chance to exercise his gift in the case of the two infants. Two prostitutes tell the same story. They lived together. They had babies at the same time. One was smothered during the night. They disagree over whose baby was still alive. Solomon determines whose baby it is by pretending that he's going to kill it and divide it. What he is after is not who is the most deserving or the most deprived, but who is telling the truth. This constitutes justice. The Old Testament also has plenty to say about injustice. Maybe if you added it up, it would perhaps say more about this than it does about actual justice. But what about our own society? In March, the media people swarmed over the case of two men convicted of murdering a sheriff's deputy. These two men were set free from life terms after 17 years, partly because of the pressure put on them by a Christian organization named Centurion Ministries. In an interview on National Public Radio, James McCloskey, the man who runs Centurion, made the claim that he was unsure whether they had murdered the man or not. They may well have. What he was certain of was that their trial had been unfair and that some witnesses had been coerced and therefore they should not have been convicted. In our country, the defendant's constitutional rights at times receive more attention than actual guilt or innocence, often to public dismay. Under the Mosaic system, it's true that even the condemned have rights. And in fact, punishment is limited. When there's a public beating, no more than 40 lashes and so forth. However, the bottom line is that the guilty remain guilty and the innocent innocent, and anything else would be unjust. Injustice in the Old Testament could arise from two sectors. First, there is legislative injustice, the creation of laws that perverts the intent of the Mosaic Code. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and rob my oppressed people of justice, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless, the prophet Isaiah. There is also judicial injustice, that is, a court decision which does not uphold the law or which does not accord with known facts. Any decision which slights the innocent or excuses the guilty is unjust. Here again, God is the great example for judges. When the reformer Jehoshaphat charges his new judges, he warns them that the Lord our God will have no part in injustice or partiality or the taking of a bribe, 2 Chronicles. It does not take a great deal of study of the warnings in the Old Testament to identify the major tools of judicial injustice within Israel. The clear favorites are false accusation, bribery, and influence peddling. This explains why some of the features of the Israelite court safeguard against these particular injustices. Even one of the Ten Commandments forbids bearing false witness against one's neighbor, Exodus 20. In a capital offense, execution would be carried out on the word of two or three witnesses, a principle that would eliminate many false accusations. But in Deuteronomy 19, it in fact broadens this rule to apply to any charge. In a dispute, these multiple witnesses should be thoroughly questioned by the judge or judges. If a witness is caught making a false accusation, he himself shall receive the penalty that befit the crime of which he was accusing. Judges must not be lax in examining the witnesses, since, as wise King Solomon observed, the first to present his case seems right until another comes forward and questions him, Proverbs 18. The other tools of injustice, bribery, influence, and favoritism, certainly could do much damage in a system where judges, not juries, delivered the verdict. Solomon again, to show partiality in judging is not good. Typically, the victims of injustice turned out to be those who lacked money for counter-bribes and those who lacked community influence. The orphan, the widow, and the resident alien form the triad of traditional casualties. Not only did they face economic and social oppression, but they might not be able to turn to the courts for redress either. The Mosaic Law, the Psalms, and Proverbs all rail against these particular abuses, and the prophets perennially point to them as invitations to God's judgment. Yahweh, the God of the covenant, they say, hates to see his redeemed people so oppressed. This is what Yahweh says, "For three sins of Israel, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. They sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample on the heads of the poor as upon the dust of the ground and deny justice to the oppressed." Prophet Amos, 8th century. Yahweh takes his place in court. He rises to judge the people. Yahweh enters into judgment against the elders and leaders of his people. "It is you who have ruined my vineyard. The plunder from the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor?" declares the Lord, Yahweh Almighty. The prophet Isaiah, late 8th century. "The people of the land practice extortion and commit robbery. They oppress the poor and needy and mistreat the alien, denying them justice." The prophet Ezekiel, early 6th century. Now the law contains economic safeguards for the poor and strictly forbids slighting them in a court of law. Absent from the law, perhaps surprisingly to some, is any indication that judges should show favor to the poor. And in fact, the Mosaic Law expressly forbids any favoritism, no matter how justified it might seem. "Do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. When you give testimony in a lawsuit, do not pervert justice by siding with the crowd. And do not show favoritism to a poor man in his lawsuit," Exodus 23. This is perhaps an indication that the mob might favor one of their own against a wealthy man, and this could lead to a miscarriage of justice. Perhaps the recent headlines might help us out again, even though a court has found her guilty, and I'm sure she is. The public uproar about Leona Helmsley, I think, can illustrate how when a rich person is caught in a search for justice, the rest of us clamor for strictness. So she was sent to jail on April 15th, not ironically, I think purposely, to the public delight. "Do not pervert justice. Do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great, but judge your neighbor fairly, Leviticus 19. Fairness means ruling in accordance with the law and with known facts, while being blind to the economic and social status of the litigants. Let's look a little bit about justice under the New Covenant and see what the New Testament says and adds to the Old. It's popularly thought that the Old Testament requires rigid justice and the New Testament requires mercy. But the New Testament bolsters the virtue of justice as well. John the Baptist tells the Roman soldiers, "Don't extort money and don't accuse people falsely. Be content with your pay," Luke chapter 3. Jesus comes to proclaim freedom for the prisoner, recovery of sight for the blind, and to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, Luke chapter 4, citing the prophet Isaiah. One of Paul's detailed teachings concerns how God can acquit the guilty and still remain a just judge in Romans 3, 25 and 26. And again, in Acts, at the end of history, it is said that God will judge the world with justice through Jesus Christ, Acts 17, 31. With regard to day-to-day justice, the Christian stands in an unusual position. He appreciates the virtue of justice keenly, yet understands that the law of the land often does not clearly reflect God's will. He should also feel a reticence about bringing another Christian before a non-Christian judge, thereby giving the world the impression that Christians cannot get along with each other. This was precisely the situation in Corinth. When Christians were cheated and wronged by fellow believers, they tried to return the same evil, and sometimes to do that before the officially pagan Bema seat in Corinth. Paul argues that it is better to drop the matter than to bring suit, and also points out that the church should be, quote, able to judge trivial cases, 1 Corinthians 6:2. Paul is not diminishing the importance of justice. In fact, he later commends the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 7 for their desire to see justice done in a particular case. What he is saying is that it must be carried out in a Christian spirit and preferably through in-house arbitration. And if it comes to that, he would rather drop the pursuit of justice if that will damage the reputation of the gospel. Taking the matter before the church is not always easy. It requires self-discipline, as well as church discipline, we assume, to make the process work, since the decision has to be voluntarily adhered to and there's no higher court of appeal for the dissatisfied. Jesus himself laid the basis for Paul's teaching in Matthew 18. When a brother sins against you, you are to address him privately, and then before other witnesses, and then before the whole church. Again, this is not a rejection of the principle of justice. It is just that the Christian must take steps to settle the matter privately and discreetly before bringing the whole church into the affair. The Deuteronomic principle that two or three witnesses must give a consistent testimony is quoted there and still valid within church discipline. James, too, warns his readers about injustice. To show favoritism to a rich man, even in the choice of seating arrangements, is to break God's law, James chapter 2. James goes on to echo the fiery Old Testament condemnation upon those who withhold the pay of day workers because of their own greed, James chapter 5. Above all, the Christian must not take personal vengeance. When he is wrong and has no further course of action, he must leave the matter to God, who is the avenger of all. Paul in 1 Thessalonians 4. What I'd like to do is to think very briefly about some modern definitions of justice and how they compare with the Bible's description of justice, which we are deducing from the texts. I'd like to focus particularly on the definition of justice propounded by liberation theology. Liberation theology is not a single system, but rather a way of thinking about theology. It begins from the assumption that God desires to help the weak and oppressed, therefore that the world's poor are favored by God, and that Christians must identify them with the poor in their struggle. Liberationists have ranged from the moderate to the extreme. For example, in the 1980s, there was quite a scandal in the National Council of Churches when groups within the NCC were found to have raised money to arm Marxist guerrillas. Others in that camp tried to speak and act prophetically on behalf of the poor and consistently reject violence. It's unfortunate that working on behalf of the poor has, in some circles, taken on the taint of leftist politics, which may intimidate Christians from doing what's right. What liberation theology has done on the positive side is to remind Western Christians that injustice does exist everywhere, that it is biblical to ensure that the poor receive their day in court. The Bible does give strong condemnations of theft and deception, of the unfair treatment of transient workers, of price gouging, of exploiting those who are desperate enough to take what pay is given them. It may seem kind of a poor time to discuss liberation theology, since it's fallen into disarray in the last few years, as one country after another has rejected socialism as a weak help for the poor. But I bring them up because of their repeated use of the term justice, and because of the confusion that this could cause. And I think some of the confusion stems from their failure to define justice clearly. Within liberation theology, from what I can deduce there on that end, the focus is on just results. Justice is equitable results. The Bible, on the other hand, while interested in just results, is also focusing on just means, the means of justice. Why is it able to do this? Well, because there are absolutes in the biblical vision. Justice is the equitable enforcement of God's absolutes, his will. If a liberation theologian sees poverty, then blame must be laid at someone's door. Thomas Hanks, for example, who's I think definitely in the moderate camp of this school of thought, states that the poor, even the lazy ones, are by definition the victims of injustice, and the rich are by definition per se oppressors. Opposing socialism is transformed by this kind of exegesis into opposing justice for the poor, and therefore rebelling against the Bible. The problem with liberation theologians is not that they have their own definition of the word justice. We all define words in odd ways. But that they read their own definition back into the Bible and into Bible verses that deal in context with, for example, the court system, judicial justice. And if liberation theology has done this, I think we'll see this in the future with some of the more radical elements of feminist hermeneutics, environmentalism, and we've also seen it with black theology. The prophet's call to let justice roll down can mean whatever the theologian says it means if he is the one that's defining justice. The definition of justice comes from man, and God's word is then used to support the cause. As an example, Gustavo Gutierrez states that in his theology of liberation, states that if you practice injustice, you do not know God. And when he says that, he sounds like one of the prophets of old. But when he goes on to say that to do justice is to know God, and for him to do justice is his program of politics and economics, then I'm afraid he's making an idol of economic equality. And it's this change in perspective that will separate liberation theology from biblically based social action. Perhaps I'll leave it at that. Maybe we can have some time for discussion.